Okay, so we began our discussion with that joint statement by the LCMS, President's Office and World Relief and Human Care, a joint statement on immigration and how to maybe think through that a little bit as church, a little bit theologically. And one of the things that we mentioned was basically the statement's concern for recapturing, in some sense, the historical roots of our spiritual fathers and mothers in Synod, to recognize that we have a history of immigration that does not only apply to the country as such, but also to our own church. And so our founding fathers, we are reminded, were immigrants, and many of them came to the States escaping religious persecution, oppression, but also came to improve the economic condition of their families. And so there's at least kind of a basic sensitivity that one is to have towards the immigrants. It's kind of a basic value. And it is important because often you have a bit of a historical amnesia because we're so detached from our immigrant past, we might not actually try to understand perhaps the plight of the migrant. So the document asks us to, at a very basic level of commitment, simply remember our spiritual fathers and mothers and their immigrant roots. So that's one element we gather from the joint statement. There is also something about the fundamental value of concern for those who are vulnerable and for making things right, for those who are orphans, widows, the alien, the oppressed, this kind of basic call that Yahweh gives to the church, makes to the church in the Old Testament. So we are asked in the joint statement to remember the migrant in our midst, the stranger in our midst. Understanding that Christians might disagree on what the best way of dealing with the problem of immigration is, but at the same time saying, despite disagreements, there is at least a fundamental value here. This much is certain, the document states, God in His Word consistently shows His loving concern for the stranger in our midst, and directs His people to do the same. So, remember your immigrant past, remember the stranger in your midst. The document also asks us not to confuse the two realms. And this goes back to the Lutheran distinction between the right-hand and left-hand realms. On the one hand, the document tells the church that she is not the government. And so it is not the role of the church to specify particular civil legislation. The church has not been called to do that. Okay, so there is an encouragement there to not confuse the two realms. So the church should not be an obstacle, in a sense, to the state. On the other hand, the church also can ask the state not to become an obstacle to the work of the church, to the proclamation of the gospel, and to the works of mercy that flow out of that gospel. And so on the one hand, the statement does recognize that the government has a God-given right to legislate. And at the same time, it says, you know, but the government should also let the church do what the church has been called to do in the world. Now, I think typically in the Missouri Synod, there will be, I suppose, a tendency at times not to say much on legislation. But once in a while, I think that we would have leaders in the church who would say, look, there is some bill coming up on something, and it brings up some moral, ethical issues. And so as Christians, you have to kind of think about that in light of the Word of God and in light of your own conscience and what is reasonable and just and godly. So that doesn't mean the church becomes the government, but the church does become sort of the conscience of society. And that is okay too. Okay. So we talked about that. The document is also helpful in terms of asking some questions. In other words, when we deal with some issue where we have some perhaps moral objections to the treatment of the vulnerable, how ought we to approach that? And the joint statement does make some suggestions. For example, one of the things that should be asked in the case, let's take of the undocumented immigrant, for example. What is just and reasonable in terms of the law? Christians should always be asking that question. And so the statement says that the Lutheran Church, on the one hand, affirms that the government is God's agent to legislate, affirms the right responsibility and authority of the government. But then it also adds, according to what is reasonable and just. Okay? At the same time, it says we recognize the responsibility of the government to regulate immigration in particular for the sake of order and peace and all of that, but in a godly manner. Okay? Which means then that we should be critical to or to have some judgment on whether the law is actually serving the neighbor. Okay? So it's something to consider. The civil law sometimes could be at odds with God's own law. So it's something to keep in mind. The law, the civil law, is not an idol. So it must also be reasonable, just, and godly. Okay? And the question there is, does it serve the neighbor or the greater majority of people who need the government to stand up for them, to serve them in some way, to regulate life so as to make room for everyone, and to do that in an orderly and peaceful way? It's a legitimate question. It is possible in Lutheran theology to distinguish, therefore, between offices and office holders. So, for example, you have government and government officials, but then you can ask questions about the laws that they put forth. A particular office holder might not always have this or that neighbor's best interest in mind necessarily. So there is a call for discernment. Okay, so we can honor government as God's gift, while at the same time protesting and perhaps even fighting in peaceful ways to change laws that might not serve our neighbor the best. And this is when the issue of civil disobedience comes up in any number of forms. As a matter of conscience, some Christians feel that it is reasonable and just, for example, in most cases, not to engage, let's say, in a massive, full-blown deportation of illegal immigrants. That it is sort of impractical, that it is for many sort of wrong because it raises issues of, are we separating families? Are we sending people back to dangerous situations? Are we sending people back to conditions where they cannot provide for their families? So there's a whole host of issues that make many Christians sort of stop when it comes to, well, let's just go and raid everywhere and have a massive full-blown deportation. Is it just? Is it reasonable? Good questions. And so there are many who feel that there is a certain measure of patience needed. It's not a perfect law. It's not comprehensive enough to deal with pressing issues. So a measure of patience is needed in dealing with immigrants as legislators find a more comprehensive way of approaching the issue that makes things right. So that's one question to ask when it comes to a moral issue. Okay, is the civil law reflecting something that is godly, that is just, that makes sense for the neighbor? So that's something to keep in mind as you deal with, for example, the issue of the undocumented immigrant. Another question. It is very difficult to argue for fulfilling the law in general. We are called to fulfill the law as we seek out to serve our neighbor according to the responsibilities that we have been given. But it becomes somewhat abstract if you don't have a particular neighbor in mind. Okay? So if you're going to argue for some legislation, you ought to be thinking at some point of the neighbor. What neighbor am I arguing for? What is my vocation? You got to argue as a starting point from that place in which God has put you. And the joint statement sort of hints at that. As corporate citizens of this nation, reads the statement, we recognize that solutions to the problem of illegal immigration are complex. There are many factors that deserve consideration, each exhibiting its own value. And then it goes into borders, national security and enforcement. Then it goes into labor, income issues. Then it goes into human rights. And what you see in this kind of statement is really the different sides of the debate when it comes to immigration. On the one hand, you have people in a post-9/11 world who want national security, the threat of terrorism, and all of this stuff. They are, in a sense, arguing for a certain neighbor, a set of neighbors. Then you have the business industry people. There is a demand for labor. They're going to argue for permits for workers, you see. They are arguing about the law and what is just and reasonable, but from the place where they have been put. What is my primary vocation? That will decide, to a large degree, what neighbor I'm going to fight and advocate for. And then you have the human rights people. You know, you have many who die crossing the border. You have many who are getting low wages once they come in. Then there's the mistreatment of the migrant because they're different from us. So the human rights issue, the human face of the migrant comes into this. It's not only a political, economic thing. There's this humanity involved in this, and people, flesh and blood. But if we try to approach the law without a neighbor in mind and without vocation in mind, it's a mess, you know. If everybody's your neighbor, nobody's your neighbor, okay? If you're an admissions counselor at Concordia Seminary, you're supposed to advocate for the recruitment of students and finding ways of doing that and making sure that when the students get here, that they're being taken care of and so on. So it's okay. I think, for example, of the Mexican father who crosses the border, he might even believe that crossing it is not legal. And he might agree with that, obey the authorities. But at the same time, he has family to take care of. So he might cross it, you know, so there's some ambiguity here. Because he has a responsibility to give some priority to his own family. So you have this kind of thing. You have the fourth commandment, obey the authorities. You have the fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill, which means promote the well-being of your neighbor. Well, which one takes priority at this point in time? For the Mexican father who crosses the border is the fifth one. So yes, there might be need to let God deal ultimately with this mess and ask him to forgive you just in case that you mess up. The same goes with a border patrol agent. He might actually disagree with immigration law, but his vocation is to stop people at the border. You see, so he's approaching the law from the perspective of his vocation and the particular neighbor he will serve. But at the same time, there is this ambiguity. Now, vocation, the Border Patrol agent has a vocational focus, stop people from coming in. But that doesn't mean that when they see someone dying in the desert, they don't do anything about it, see? At that point, they go and they have many, and many occasions, save lives. So, on the one hand, the law is sort of above vocation. You can't say to the needy neighbor, you don't fit within my vocation, I'm not going to help you. I can't do that. But at the same time, you cannot really fulfill the law except through, or concretely through, vocation. So the Mexican father who says, you know, my vocation first is for my children, so I'm going to cross. So again, a good question to ask. Not only what is just and reasonable and godly, but another good question is, what is my vocation? And therefore, who is my neighbor? Who am I advocating for? Where am I arguing from? It's entirely okay to do that. It is my concrete neighbor who determines then who I advocate for and how much weight I give to various factors in a debate. Am I going to give weight to the national security factor? Am I going to give weight to the business factor? Am I going to give weight to a family unity factor? Or helping those who are in economic need factor? Depends. What is your vocation? Another question you want to ask, too, is who is the neediest among all my neighbors? In other words, no one disagrees that one should help out the neighbor. The question is, who do I help out first? Where does the priority of my love go? Understanding that I have many, of course, to serve and take care of. But if you look at the undocumented immigrant, and even immigrants in general, they could be seen as some of the neediest people in many ways. They leave their family, their culture, language, something that is quite difficult to do. And then once they come into a new place, they're typically branded in different ways, not always treated fairly. So they undergo many types of subtle or outright oppression. The joint statement hints at the struggles that an immigrant goes through. They flee oppression of many sorts, including extreme poverty and hunger. They come in order to make provision for their loved ones. They have come in order to end separation from loved ones. So at times you have people in the same family living on different sides of the border. So we have many neighbors to serve. But a question we can ask is, when there is a conflict of vocational commitments between different neighbors and different responsibilities towards them, where does the priority of my love comes or goes to? Who does the priority of my love goes to? And here, what I remember often is this idea of the preferential option for the poor. Many of the migrants are among the poorest of the poor. And in Latin America, this term was sort of coined. And it has been a controversial term, because when people look at this, they say, well, does that mean that the rich cannot be saved or something like that? But that is not really what the term was getting at. When it was brought up, the idea was that there should always be some neighbor that is needier than another. And so the priority of our concern goes to them first. And those who are in my class know the illustration that I typically bring up. I have a 7-year-old and I have a 4-year-old. And when they were a little bit younger, the older one would ask me to play with him. I want to play with you, Daddy. And then you have the little one who has a poopy diaper and needs some milk. Well, I love them both. But my preferential option at that particular moment goes to the one who is neediest. Okay, and I think you know who that is simply by the smell of the diaper. Here's another question that you might consider as well when you deal with difficult ethical issues. Who are all affected in any particular decision I make? Luther is helpful here in his treatment on temporal authority. He makes a distinction between an individual Christian and how much he or she can take, and a Christian who's actually related to many neighbors and responsible to them. He puts it this way: a Christian, or an individual Christian, we might say, should be so disposed that he will suffer every evil and injustice without avenging himself, without becoming the government himself, you know, something like that. On behalf of others, however, He may and should seek vengeance, justice, protection, and help, and do as much as he can to achieve it. So here's a lesson we can draw from that. One thing is what you're able to take as an individual. I might be willing to turn the other cheek if it's an issue dealing with me. In other words, if I'm an individual, single guy, it might be okay if I'm deported right away. I might not lose too much. But what if I am the head of a household and I have many who depend on me, you see? That changes the picture a little bit more. I think of the gunman who enters the house. If I'm by myself, maybe I'll turn the other cheek. You know, go ahead and steal, and maybe he might even hurt me. But I doubt that I'll go down without a fight, you know, just so you know. But you can take so much as an individual. But what if my wife and children are in the house? Boy, that's going to change the picture a little bit. See? It could be that even as a way of defending them or taking care of them, I might end up, God forbid, even killing the guy, unless he gets me first. You know, it just changes the picture. One thing is what you might be able to take as an individual Christian. But as someone who's responsible for others, you have really no choice but to promote their well-being and to advocate for them and defend their lives. Okay? So one thing is to be a Mexican individual crossing the desert. Another is to be a Mexican father, mother, crossing the desert to find work to feed the children. Okay, so it's something to think about. One thing is to turn in an illegal, an undocumented immigrant who's fairly young, single, and a troublemaker. An entirely different manner is, an entirely different issue is to get a head of a household or breadwinner of an entire family deported, or a child of an illegal immigrant who has been raised in the U.S. and knows no other culture and friends, or a refugee who upon deportation faces extreme poverty and danger where she came from. So again, who are all affected in decisions I have to make about this or that law? Something to keep in mind. Okay, and then let's go to another point. We want to make here. Yeah, this is quite an interesting one. Obviously, we live in both realms. Okay, so you want to be a faithful citizen, father, mother, business person on the left-hand realm. And at the same time, you will all be functioning also in terms of primary vocations as pastors and deaconesses in the right-hand realm. And so you have a desire to be a dutiful citizen, father, mother, etc. But also you have a responsibility to be a faithful pastor and deaconess. And there will be times when those vocations will come somewhat into conflict, okay? And this is what I want to bring up. That at times, you could say something like, well, you know, I want to go to some immigration reform rally as a citizen. See, because I can make a nice distinction for myself between the left hand and the right hand kingdom. So I'm going to go as a citizen. I'm not going to wear my collar, you know. I'm not going to wear my deaconess garb. I'm just simply going to go as a citizen. And you go downtown and you're doing this, and then there are people from your community who see you there. And what are they going to say? They're not going to say that's Mr. and Mrs. Citizen. If they know anything about the ministry, they're going to say that's pastor this and that's deaconess that, you know. And if they like the fact that you're for comprehensive immigration reform, they're probably very happy with you and they'll go to your church next Sunday. If they're not very happy with that, you know, all of a sudden they might say, well, I don't want to go there because they're just involved in the political. So even though there are things that you can do as a citizen, at times you might have to refrain from doing them so that you don't become an obstacle to the gospel. which you want to promote in the right-hand realm. Another example of this would be, and this is not, you know, something that is so far out there, especially in the United States today. You go to a town that's increasingly Latino, okay? And you have a member of the congregation who is vocal about his opposition to illegal immigration, so vocal that he's involved in every single immigration rally that wants to advocate for illegal immigrants to go home and all of this stuff. Well, you have an increasingly Latino community, but they know you have this overzealous citizen over there at the church. They're afraid that this guy could call immigration on him, or you know. So again, here's an instance where you have a member of the church who's acting as a citizen, and probably rightly so. He has the right, you might say, to do that. But in doing so, everyone in the community is no longer trusting the church because they associate this overzealous citizen with this particular church. You know, so that's a case where, in an increasingly Latino neighborhood, which is more often than not the case, and will be more so as we go out into the ministry in the United States, not to do things that you could perhaps otherwise do as a citizen if they're going to become an obstacle for you to be able to proclaim the gospel among a people's group. So these are all difficult questions to ask. I would just sort of say, and I get calls about this quite often, there are pastors who are approached in the field by some immigrant here and there whose status might be questionable, or they might be just undocumented, and they come to the pastor or they come to the deaconess, and they're quite open about their situation. See? At that point, they're not looking at you as a citizen. They're looking at you as a pastor or deaconess. So your primary vocation to that neighbor at that point is not to try to figure out all the issues with their legal status, but actually to give the gospel to them, the works of mercy that flow from the gospel. And then you should let someone else deal with the complex issues surrounding immigration law, because immigration law is really quite complex. Okay? So focus within the vocation in which someone has approached you and begin there. There is, of course, a concern for people to have it's in some ways what they need to survive. But your primary vocation, if they approach you in confidence as the pastor or the deaconess, is really to take care of that dimension of things, even as you engage others. Okay, as you engage others to deal with the legal issues. Okay, so don't get too entangled on that. But I hope that the questions I have raised at least help you to negotiate a little bit this issue of how does one deal with ethical issues, how does one deal with the civil law, in terms of not confusing the two realms, but at the same time engaging the issue from the perspective of your vocation. That is a more concrete way, a solid starting point to begin the discussion. Okay, so that is what I wanted to share with you this morning on the issue of theological reflection on immigration, keeping in mind particularly the issue of the undocumented immigrant. But I think that many of these questions could be asked of any ethical issue. I will go ahead and put these on PowerPoint so that you have easy access to them. And for test purposes, you will be asked to be able to make the distinction between the two realms. You will be asked to think about vocation, and perhaps you might even get a case study where you have to put this to use and apply them. Are there any questions that you have from what we have discussed this morning before we go to our sectionals? Yes, please.
Crossing the border, it comes across the issue of prioritizing family and Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that depends on, well, the question really has to do with when you deal with issues of the neighbor and the priority of love that you give to the neighbor. The question is whether it's okay for someone to come into the United States and through undocumented status receive employment. Is it okay for that person to steal in order to feed the family, you know? Well, let me put it this way. I think that the issue is not whether you agree with the law. The issue is not always whether you want to fulfill the law. The issue is that sometimes how you do that will come into conflict with a certain priority you have to give to a very concrete neighbor. Okay, so if feeding your children is a higher priority at a point in time than gaining some kind of employment without legal documents, okay, then that's something between you and God. And if you're caught, you'll probably be deported, okay? But your conscience might be okay with that because you were helping those in need, whom God has also called you to help, okay? So you could turn this around too. You could actually say, well, let's see. I might have to get a job even though I'm not here legally, okay? But I'd rather not do that because, you know, that would be going against the law. So I'm going to let my children die. You see? So in other words, again, these are not easy questions to answer, you know. But they're difficult to get at unless you are thinking of a concrete neighbor and a concrete vocation you're arguing for and someone that you want to advocate for and defend and help. Okay? So the gray area is meant to remain gray. But at the same time, you have to make a decision at some point because you're not acting as an individual. You're acting as someone who has responsibilities towards other people, you know. And so in the end, you can always say, well, God, forgive me for anything that I have done wrong, but I'm also doing this for my neighbor who needs me. And you also command me to do that, you know. So you have that kind of tension and ambiguity. And when you come to ethical issues, you have to be able to deal with that. Now, of course, there are other issues we can go into. The fact of the matter is that people don't cross the border unless there's a demand for labor on the other side. So to brand all illegal immigrants as people who are stealing is a little bit dishonest here. We're sending a mixed message to people. We're saying, if you want to cross the border and risk your life, that's okay, because there will be a job waiting for you on the other side. So we need to deal with the law on our side of the border before we brand all immigrants as people who steal. We have needs here in this country, in the agricultural sector, in the service sector, in the business and industry, construction sectors, and we benefit from the work of migrants, and their hard labors end up feeding many of us. So to say I can have it both ways, I can have all their hard labors and all the fruits that come out of that, and then also call them people who are stealing, is, you know, it's just a little bit too much. So you see, it's hard to argue these issues of law and what is just and reasonable unless your starting point is a concrete neighbor that you want to deal with. And also, you have to look at the state of the law. Is immigration law at this point serving the neighbor in some comprehensive sense? You know, that's what laws are supposed to do. And there is questions about that. This is why there is a debate on this stuff, you know? A healthy, good debate on this stuff. It is also a hot potato because the issues that you bring up are difficult ones. It's a hot potato issue. No candidate has even touched that issue of immigration. You've noticed. No one talks about it. Okay? These are the people that we're supposed to vote for next week. Okay? No one is talking about that stuff. It's a hot potato issue. Heavy. Okay? But the joint statement from the LCMS, in a sense, seems to be saying, I'm not going to tell you how to legislate, government, but I'm going to tell the people here that we need to reach some kind of immigration reform that's better than what we have. And so the document hints at the notion of sort of promoting more of a comprehensive reform. Now, you might disagree with that individually as a Christian, but our church body tends to be on the side of a comprehensive immigration reform, at least officially, through these somewhat official channels of the joint statement. Yes? Yeah, but I would say yes, the immediate occasion for the statement was sort of a part of a reform that attempted to criminalize any kind of action that was done to help an undocumented immigrant. And so the church said, well, hold on a second, you know, we deal with undocumented immigrants all the time. And so this is a case of the government becoming an obstacle for the church to proclaim the gospel and do the works of mercy that follow from that. And I think that's one of the occasions, at least, that brought up the document. But I think the document is moving beyond simply saying we have an individual responsibility to think about the vulnerable and those in need. In terms of food and clothing and things like that. You know, I think he's talking about, and I think you hinted at this, something at the level of kind of national legislation that attempts to get a hold of the issue somehow in a kind of practical way, you know. And so it's an issue not only of what I can do individually. I agree that that's kind of the starting point. You got to start from your vocation. But there is also a desire that there will be some kind of structure in place that can deal with the issue. See, we in our tradition tend to deal with the problem of sin sort of individually. You know, if I am able to know of the forgiveness that the Lord has given me, you know, I can find sort of I can repent personally of the sins that I've committed, and so I can do something to maybe deal with that, you know. But then there's another way of looking at things, which is complementary to this, which is to say there are some ways in which, you know, functionally and structurally in society, some things are kind of out of place. And so there you need kind of legislation to take care of that. And, you know, you can even think of the idea of structural sin. That is to say that individual sin often has negative effects on a whole bunch of people. You think of the economy, for example, the greed of some all of a sudden leave many people without what they need to provide for their neighbors, you know. So, yes, I think the document is saying, as a Christian, be sensitive to the fact that the government cannot just begin to criminalize every act of mercy that the church is involved in. That's kind of overstepping its boundaries, your government overstepping boundaries. At the same time, by pointing in the direction of a hope for a more comprehensive reform, the synod is also saying, you know, there's got to be something that is reasonable, just godly at a national level too. We have to move on here, please. And we'll take this one as the last one. Well, I would say a number of things. First, you don't want a Christian immigration law, because I'm not sure that that exists, okay? But rather, as a Christian, you want to ask what is reasonable, what is just, you see, what is godly here. And, of course, your basic fundamental values about human life and such things, which you bring from the Word of God, but you might also argue from natural law. This, we were created to make things right with the neighbor. Might bring something to bear on your decision, okay? So just wanted to make sure that we don't confuse the two realms, you know, by trying to create a Christian immigration law. That's one issue. The other issue that you bring up, though, is an important one. In other words, if I want to be consistently pro-life about any number of issues, and that's a fundamental value for me, does the fact that many migrants die crossing the desert mean anything? Well, if it does, then, you know, maybe I want to go go to some rally that, you know, promotes comprehensive immigration or something like that, or simply wants to put a human face on the issue of immigration. But I do want to point out that whether you do that in the case of abortion or euthanasia, or you do that in the case of, people who die crossing the border, keep in mind that at times people, especially if you're in your community, they will recognize you as the pastor. Or in the case of the sisters, you know, the deaconess or something like that. And they might say, well, you know, this guy is involved in the political realm publicly, and he's really a pastor and he should be doing that. So what I'm saying is that you could, as a citizen, take a certain position publicly, but it could affect what you're able to do as a pastor and a deacon. So just be aware of that. Okay? Just be aware of it. All right, thank you, guys. We better go to our sectionals and have a little discussion on that.